under the Clean Air Act regulations is that you use this suppressant to keep the chrome fumes down. It was literally part of the regulations. It kept the chrome fumes down from going up into the atmosphere and exposing the public, but also from exposing the workers. Well, the most effective one is that PFAS. And so where you see machine shops, you're starting to see this PFAS coming out into public land treatment works and water. So it's not even just firefighting. It's all over the place. So for some enterprising person, that would make like a nice little master's thesis, would be sort of follow the trail of how all this happened.
If one of you wants to start your own specialty law firm, you could probably do a small niche practice in just airports. Whenever they film a runway, it's PFAS.
Yeah, absolutely. These are the kinds of lines you can end up with PCBs. You know, PCBs have been dead since 1976, and I still don't know what they want for PCBs. I mean, these chemicals just keep on giving us more and more. This is an example of what can happen under lead paint. This was a consent decree that the New York City Housing Authority, they just entered into this in June. And they have committed to spend really big time money under this consent decree to do a better job of managing lead paint in all the public housing. Tosca modernization, for a number of the reasons I was just mentioning, people were not happy with Tosca, the asbestos decision, slow testing rules, a bunch of things like that. And there was actually general agreement. It was an amazing, interesting process, the process of Tosca modernization, because the public interest groups and industry were actually reasonably close on a surprising number of issues, far apart on some other issues, as would be expected. But these were the basic kinds of issues. The public interest concerns obviously put more burden on the companies. Precautionary principle, it should be presumed dangerous unless proven innocent rather than the other way around. You know, a lot of the kind of expected kind of positions. Industry, on the other hand, even the American Chemistry Council, they thought that Tosca should be modernized because Europe had passed enacted comprehensive chemical regulation called REACH in the early 2000s. And if you were a multinational, it was just getting complicated to comply with both REACH and Tosca. And so there was an interest in international harmonization. There was a concern about green initiatives from the states were starting to get complicated. You know, California, Oregon, Washington, Vermont, New Hampshire. And if you were a chemical company, you were thinking, wouldn't it be better just to have one set of rules for your feds? And then, you know, I know this is being recorded, but there was sort of this sad, misguided hope amongst the chemical industry that somehow if Tosca was tougher, that somehow the chemical industry would get more credibility. I had no clue what they were thinking about that. You know, NRDC is not going to love DuPont one whit more, no matter what the law says. But they were thinking that. The Frank R. Lautenberg Memorial Chemical Safety Act, he died, 6 months before it was signed? A year?
It's pretty sad.
And this was like he worked on this for a decade. And, you know, New Jersey is sort of the chemical state. He had an interesting relationship, Lautenberg did, with the chemical industry.
I'm having a student trying to dial in, and she says she can't, so I'm going to reboot the session. Let's keep talking about this.
Okay, I can keep talking through anything. Interestingly enough, it was pretty much a bipartisan event. If you can look from the vote counts, there were very few R's voted against it. And it's kind of interesting that you had such bipartisan support for a really major environmental statute, particularly at a time, you know, in 2016, when basically McConnell's position was, I'm not going to do anything that makes it look like Obama ever accomplished anything, particularly in the run-up to the election. Things were basically come to a standstill. So it was really quite a shock that it came through that well. And a lot of the reason, I think among the reasons were that it had been worked on for like 10 or 15 years. You had pretty strong support from both the NGO community and the industry community. And I think both the NGOs and industry thought this was the best deal they were going to get. Now, I think in hindsight, I think the NGOs were right and industry was wrong. I was a little surprised when I heard the industry folks thinking this was the best deal they were going to get, because I don't think it's the best deal they could have got if they had waited. And there's no doubt that this is the best deal that the public interest groups were going to get. There's a bunch of things that are in it, and we'll walk through it. I'm already going to be behind, so I'm going to have to start speeding up, because as you can tell, I take lots of detours. Drives everybody, including my wife, crazy. EPA has to sort of reset the inventory to make the inventory try to actually match what is on the market, because right now there's probably about 10 or 15,000 chemicals on the inventory that aren't even being used. And so it's trying to make the inventory match reality and also begin a process, which they could have begun in 1976, but they didn't, of prioritizing and doing risk-based evaluations of those tens of thousands of grandfathered chemicals that have not been looked at. A more stringent new chemical review process, lower thresholds for requiring test data. It used to be EPA would have to go through these complicated rules. EPA would almost have to prove that the chemical posed a substantial risk before they could require testing. And some people said, well, that's kind of a catch-22, because the whole reason you want to do the testing is to see if it poses a substantial risk. So the barriers were made less tough for EPA to require testing. And then we're not going to have time to get into too much today, but there's a slide there that can drive you to drinking on a very complex compromise on preemption of state laws, which even though in the real world I don't think it's as important as everybody thinks it is, was probably one of the most heavily debated issues. Even though in the practical world, you know, 2.5 years in, I don't think a single preemption issue has shown up, even though it just got all the attention. Just goes to show. This is the simple part. And really what I can do, I have the hard part by EDF, and I've got a slightly simpler version here. For existing chemicals, the first thing, you know, one of the things EPA has to do is figure out which are the ones that are active on the market and get rid of the ones on the inventory that are not. That regulatory process is in the works right now. Then what EPA has to do is prioritize. So they have to figure out what the high priority chemicals are, and then everything else is a low priority. They had a duty to, right up front, within 6 months of passage, identify their top 10. We'll get to that in a second. That top 10 has already been identified, and that process has started. And then it's testing and assessment. Do those top 10 pose an unreasonable risk to human health or the environment? And if EPA can't conclude that they're not reasonably likely to pose that kind of a risk, then we're off in the world, some kind of restrictions, bans, that kind of thing. So that's the world of existing chemicals. This along with preemption, and you can see from the complicated version of why it took so long, is there's all kinds of steps. You know, there's the inventory reset, then there's the prioritization, and then what do you do if you don't have enough information? Then you have work plans, and you ask the companies for data. Then they do the risk evaluation. There's a lot of steps. This, along with preemption, was the bulk of the debate.
Actually, Chris, before you move that away from that slide, just to sort of help make this real for you guys, think about the materials that I pulled out of the briefcase here on Monday. Remember the golf ball? The golf ball was filled with nanoscale and basically buckyballs. How would this apply to that? What questions would you ask? And we don't have to work it through now, but if you're reviewing how Tosca works, let's just operationalize it. What sort of questions do you have to ask? Is it on the inventory? If it is on the inventory now, is it going to be ranked by EPA as being active or inactive? If it is active, is it going to be something that will be high priority or low priority? What would make the difference? What do you have to do if you want to sell these golf balls? And you have, let's say, 1,000 kilograms of mysterious buckyball nanoscale carbon, and your Tosca status is unknown. It sounds really science fiction-y, except that I worked with a company in exactly that situation in West Houston that was making it an industrial scale reactor. It looked like a rail car, vertical. And they didn't know what to do. It was a potential multi-million dollar penalty. So this stuff matters.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about working through this stuff is that it's very business oriented. Because instead of sort of figuring out, gee, what do I do with my waste, which is called waste management, they'll figure it out for you. Here, you're actually dealing with product designers and also figuring out what the time to market issues are. Because you get all these startups, they actually think they're speed in this their world, right? Then you explain to them, yeah, you got to submit this stuff to EPA, and the EPA gets to think about it for 3 months. Tops of their heads just go, well, think about it for 3 months. You know, we haven't been in existence for 2 weeks, and we think we've got a $1 billion business model. And so it's a really interesting process of trying to help manage that process. For the existing chemicals, you know, this is the risk standard. And of course, unreasonable is in the eye of the beholder. That's never defined. But a couple of key points about this, perhaps the key point about it, is that when EPA is making an unreasonable risk determination, it's without consideration of cost. That is in there because of corrosion-proof fittings. That's a corrosion-proof fitting sentence. Because if you read corrosion-proof fittings, they said EPA did a lousy job of looking at the cost issues, among other things. So not only EPA can't take cost into account, they also have to look at potentially exposed susceptible subpopulations. Susceptible subpopulations is code talk for children, the elderly, like me. And folks like that. This is another hot button. What do you mean by conditions of use? Is condition of use mean anything it could be conceivably used for? Does it mean anything it could be reasonably used for, you know, reasonably anticipated? Or does it mean the intended use by the manufacturer and the seller? For some amazing reason, the chemical industry actually thought this meant intended use by the manufacturer, even though that's not what it said. It's become a really big issue. And this work is going on right now for 10 chemicals, the identity of which I think I'll get in front of you for just a few moments. The world of new chemicals, a little bit simpler boxes. And by the way, on this slide, FRL, that means the Frank-Lautenberg bill. So this was EDF's version where you could kind of compare and contrast old Tosca with the Lautenberg bill. So this is kind of a nice slide that I got from them. Probably the key thing that I think is different about the new chemicals process is that it used to be that a company would make their submission to EPA, chemical data, exposure data, whatever. EPA had a well-honed machine, big staff, computer modeling, and they would go through these really cool risk evaluations, but it was by default. So if EPA did nothing after 90 days, you were good to go. So EPA had veto power, but they did not have to positively say it was okay. The huge change is that EPA has to make an affirmative determination that it won't pose an unreasonable risk. I did a lot of work on Tosca reauthorization back when I was spending a lot of time in DC. And when I talked especially to the industry folks, I said, now you have to understand, I said, this is all good, But you have to understand the psychological difference that makes. If you're a GS-12 sitting in a cubicle, there's a big difference between saying, I don't see a problem with something, I will let it go, and putting your John Hancock down and saying, signing my name, am personally saying, I don't think there's a foreseeable problem with this chemical. Huge difference. That difference there has just about come close to bringing the new chemical review process to a stop. And again, people were expressing surprise, shock, and dismay about the impact of this on the new chemicals program. And it just, you just look at it and you just sort of say, how could you have just not figured this one out? Sometimes I think lawyers are just not really thoughtful about real world normal stuff. They kind of look at the legal language, but don't think about the dynamics of how things are going to actually work. And the new chemical piece really does get into the kind of stuff that Tracy was talking about. Because when that person shows up with the buckyballs, or I had one, it was a company that would have some funky nano-based, liquid-based nanochemical that was used on slides for purposes of doing cancer research and stuff like that. And you go through all of the details, you have to look at all the component parts. Are any of the component parts on the TSCA inventory? Chances are the answer is no. Another question is, do you guys even know what the component parts are? Half the time the answer is no. Especially like on the thing you're talking about, they've got a reactor and it's a bunch of goo. You say, what's in the goo? That's goo. You know, well, what's in it? What is the molecular formula? And to maybe make a very bad pun, this is very granular chemistry stuff, because when you make a PMN submission, one of these new chemical notices, you have to provide the molecular formula. Some of this has almost intellectual property tones to it, because if your molecular structure is like the other guy's molecular structure, then you actually don't have to submit a PMN, because that means your molecular structure is already on the inventory and you're good to go. You get an interesting issue if you're working with a company. The IP people want to say, your stuff is unique. The TSCA lawyers would say, you know, it's a lot easier if you say your stuff is like the other guy's stuff. And it gets into very detailed stuff, because carbon chains count. So if you've got something that's a C6 and what's on the inventory is a C7, EPA will ding you for not being on the inventory, because a C6 and a C7 are different. And then you just have to work through this whole process. What kind of data do you have? Well, I don't know. You know, it's going to take a while. Yeah, try to go get human health data on a new chemical. How much time do you have? Because that literally can take years. So there's a lot of work that goes into this process. And so when you're working, especially with companies that are trying to be high-tech market leaders, you know, they want to put the latest cool thread in clothes. Textile people have real issues with this kind of stuff, is that there's lead time with all this stuff. I'm just going to say it's the pre-engineering tangle. It's a very, very complicated process that I think the short form of this, it was basically designed to keep certain senators from California happy, so that the California Green Chemistry Act would not be preempted by TSCA, so that they could get her vote. Because you weren't going to get Feinstein's vote unless you protected the California Green Chemistry Program. To protect the Green Chemistry Program without naming it, because that's just really inappropriate in legislation, you then have to write all of this interesting language, and you end up with something. We don't really have time to sort of get into it. And interestingly enough, after all of that work, is like I said, we're a couple of almost 3 years in, and I'm not aware of a single preemption issue. The initial returns, we still have good bipartisan support. You know, I don't hear the McConnell crowd or anybody else like that saying, well, let's repeal this thing. You're not hearing that? I mean, you know, there's some partisan divides. You know, within a few months after it being enacted and signed by President Obama, the Republicans and the Democrats each came out with their own interpretations of legislative history on a whole number of issues. Certain Dems are already calling for some hearings. I would think that if the Dems win the House, you'll probably see some TSCA hearings on certain kinds of issues. But compared to other issues that you guys have probably been talking about, like waters of the United States and stuff like that, this has been more normal. You know, the amount of fighting that you're seeing over TSCA implementation is to me about the same amount I think you would have seen if Clinton had won, in my view. And EPA seems to be putting credible effort into it. There's some debate about budgets and stuff like that. A bunch of rulemakings have been launched. So far, this is a lousy candidate for good classic common law, case law, law schools, because it's all so fresh that there are no decisions yet. Some of the first oral arguments have just taken place in some of the cases. So
just to give you a sense of the importance of why we're talking about this particular statute, quick mental check here. Can you think of when the last major environmental statute was passed by Congress before this one? We studied it in class. Remember when those were? 1990, very good. So 27 years. This is an enormous bipartisan accomplishment. We haven't seen any environmental legislation of significance in that interim, except for some rifle shot bills. So we can make side bets as to whether or not this is a harbinger of future cooperation, but I'm putting my bet we're right back to gridlock now.
It could be, you never know. I mean, what you have to do is find a statute that everyone agrees is not working. And I'm not sure you have a lot of argument over particular regulations, mm-hmm. like waters of the United States and some of the Clean Air Act stuff. But I'm not sure, maybe outside of Superfund, I'm not sure if you could really say the Clean Air Act is not working, or the Clean Water Act is not working. There are huge debates about it. But that's a different issue than whether the statute's working. What you had with TSCA, the key thing was the American Chemistry Council decided they wanted it to change. If it had been just the Enviros, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. But when you had the American Chemistry Council, the Consumer Products Trade Association, basically all of the major industry trades were behind this. So I think that's what made it really unusual. You know, because if you're on the public interest side, you're trying to change these bloody things all the time. But if you don't get, if industry hadn't been behind it, the artists wouldn't have gotten behind it, and you wouldn't have bipartisan support. New chemicals. A lot of fights about the interpretation of foreseeable use. Under the Obama EPA, it was very, very broad. In other words, it was basically, if I'm the reviewer looking at this new chemical thing coming in, which could be everything from a nanomaterial, it could be a new kind of lubricant, it could be a new kind of finishing for metal, I mean, it could just be all kinds of stuff that people use, is that I'm thinking about, well, where are all the different places it could end up? Because that's the issue. When you're looking at these things as a reviewer, what birds and bees are going to be exposed to it, what people are going to be exposed to it, is it going to be in the air, is it going to be in the water? And it used to be, under the old TSCA, they would, a reviewer would simply look at what the manufacturer said it was going to be used for, and that was it. Under the Obama EPA, they really broadened that, and they started thinking, well, what are all the possible downstream uses? If you think about it, it's the equivalent of off-label marketing in the drug world, where a drug was made for this, and they find out it works for that, and all of a sudden they start advertising it for something it was never originally licensed for. It's that same kind of an issue. About a few months ago, in the context of a rulemaking on a specific chemical called a significant new use rule, the current EPA narrowed it right back down to basing it solely on the uses identified by the submitter of the new chemical piece. That's going to get litigated. I mean, because that's a huge issue. And, you know, you can sort of see, you know, if I'm looking at it from a public interest perspective, I want it as broad as possible. But, you know, if you're some small specialty chemical manufacturer and I want it because it's going to be part of, you know, Tracy Hester's golf ball company, I'm going to go absolutely nuts if I got some EPA reviewer says, yeah, this is going to work great in golf balls, but you know, it could end up in baby toys too. And I'll say, oh my God, now what do I do? You know?
So just based on generally what you said, obviously we don't know a lot about statute, but this seems more of a consumer protective statute than an environmental protective statute. Is that correct?
It's the most consumer protection oriented statute of the environmental statutes. But it's actually multimedia. So when you go through this, and that's when you get into this issue of very conservative exposure assumptions, you're looking at assumptions during the manufacturing process, even to the point of EPA in their computer modeling, they have baked in assumptions that every 55-gallon drum that has this stuff in it and it's emptied, there's going to be X amount of it left in the bottom, and that X amount of it's going to get washed out. And that X amount is going to get washed out to a treatment system that can't treat it, so it's all going to go in the river. So they do those kinds of things as well, but also they're looking at the consumer use side and the worker exposure side, which has safety lawyers all up in arms. But you're absolutely right. This has got much more of a consumer bent than the other statutes. The cost issue, very conservative assumptions. In this key here, which is the hesitation of making affirmative findings that a chemical is not likely to pose an unreasonable risk. And this is played out in the numbers. You know, it used to be a 90-day regime, 90-day wonders, and you were done. And in the old days, back in the good old days, by the way, SNURs, that's Tosca Kotok, these are called significant new use rules. And these are imposed if EPA finds that there's a problem with the chemical. A significant new use rule is a chemical specific rule that imposes restrictions on it. It can be restrictions on volume, it can be personal protective equipment for workers, it can be the kinds of uses and all of that. And basically a significant new use rule establishes all of the conditions, all of the rules for using that specific chemical, and then it says, if you're going to do anything different from this regulation, you have to come back to us and get permission. So these are important kinds of rules. Up until the Lautenberg Act, 6% of the submissions ended up with these significant new use rules. Post-Lautenberg, 57%. As you can imagine, the chemical industry is howling about this. A much higher percentage of withdrawn PMNs. Withdrawn PMNs is code talk for we give up. You know, you're asking for a bunch of information. You know, it's going to cost us a lot of time and money. Time and money is not good if you're trying to get to market, so we're just going to drop it. We're just not going to do it. So if you look at these two things, 57%, 26%, you know, basically, from industry's perspective, they're saying 80% of our submissions are running into roadblocks here versus about 6 or 7% under the old law. Obviously, it's a mixed response. The industry advocates say you're stifling innovation, you're killing our industry, which, by the way, that's exactly what the European chemical industry is saying about REACH. They're saying they're all moving out. Our guys are all saying we're all going to move out. I wonder where they're all going to move to. Sooner or later, it's all going to catch up to them. And, you know, some of them are just making good old crass economic arguments. Other ones are saying, hey, we're trying to be innovative and make the new iPhone, or we're trying to make chemicals that are safer, and even if my chemical is safer, it's being held up. All these kinds of arguments. Obviously, from a public interest perspective, from the NGO's perspective, they're saying, this is the whole point. The whole point was stop, look, and listen. Be more careful in all of that. This was unexpected by some because, oddly enough, the new chemicals program got almost no attention during the whole modernization process because there was general agreement, even amongst the NGOs, that the new chemical program was actually working pretty well. of all the chemicals that people are having trouble with, the PFOSs and all this other weird stuff, those are all grandfathered chemicals. I'm not aware of a single chemical that went through the new chemical process since 1976 that's become one of those poster boy, oh my God, why did we have kinds of chemicals? So it's unintended consequences, again, the parts that got the least amount of attention are created, because these are serious conversations. You know, when you call up a client, for example, well, no, they want a 2-year study. You just literally kind of have to hold the phone. Existing chemicals, it's puttering along. Oddly enough, the real impact has been on the new chemical program that got no attention. The existing chemical program, which got all of the attention, it's just plugging along as slow as can be. Because number one, there's like 60 or 80,000 of them, right? Well, they had to pick 10 out of that, right? And some of those 10 were already being phased out anyway. I mean, there's still uses of asbestos, and asbestos had to be on the list because of corrosion-proof fittings. I mean, the minute Lautenberg, the act was signed, there were letters from everywhere, senators saying, you better put asbestos on the list. They saluted, they put asbestos on the list. From a real exposure point of view, was that really the right move? I doubt it. Stuff like trichloroethylene, these are all solvents. But the thing is, this is a slow boat. You know, this is going to take years to do this. There were some other Obama-era efforts on restrictions, and there is some concern that, as they like to say in the union world, that EPA is going to work to rule and not do anything more than what the rules require. And so there is some concern that some of these efforts under the Obama EPA that were already moving on restrictions, I think on methyl chloride and TCE and one other one, that these might be getting slowed down. And the focus is going to be just on the straight. We're going to look at the 10. We're going to march through. This is all going to take years, though. And that's the interesting thing about this. This part's going to take years, whereas the new chemical piece had literally an impact within a month. There was a backlog in affecting commerce. EPA has also initiated the resetting process. This is an interesting issue for all the companies out there that say, I'm not a chemical company. I don't need to worry about TSCA. If you're a small user of a small volume chemical, and that manufacturer decides, you know, it's just not worth it for me to keep that damn thing on the inventory, I'm just going to let it go. And you're the downstream user, now what do you do? Because you do have a lot of this on. So this issue, even though most downstream users of chemicals, the golf ball manufacturers, are not paying any attention to this, there could be chemicals coming off of the inventory that they thought they were going to be able to use. And again, it all sounds like chemicals you can use. What it means then is you're not going to make a product. Some other issues that lawyers love to fight about. The first one I really wonder what's the point sometimes. But confidential business information has always been a huge fight in TSCA. You know, the industry is always convinced that people are going to steal their crown jewels. The public interest groups are always convinced that they're not worried about their crown jewels and their IP. They're just trying to hide bad data and bad facts. And it's just, this is going to go on forever. The Lautenberg Bill Act made it harder for companies to protect confidential business information. It imposed more requirements on them if they're going to justify it. It used to be you could just stamp CBI. And you were done. And now you actually have to justify it, and they'll actually review it, which is, to me, all good stuff. Some of the current litigation is about CBI. This is a huge issue. It goes way beyond TSCA. It goes into any of the risk-based issues like Superfund and cleanup. Is the issue of what constitutes good science. There's a huge fight going on right now. There's a so-called secret science regulation that has been proposed by the current EPA that on its face sounds great. You know, best available science should be limited to science that's publicly available, publicly reproducible, and publicly verifiable. Sounds like mom and apple pie. Problem with that is a lot of health-based studies are based upon your private data and private health data. And you start, and so you might not be able to release that. So if some university professor or lab has conducted a bunch of toxicity work and clinical work working with individuals, they might not be able to release that information. But it might be really good data. But if they can't release it and they can't make it publicly available, then it wouldn't be best available science, and then EPA couldn't use it. You know? On the flip side is, you people say, on the flip side, they say, but how can you regulate stuff based on a black box that I can't reproduce? Because what are you telling me? That I just have to trust you that it's good science? It's a, and in the typical debate, a lot of the debate, like many of the debates today, is characterized by just a lot of name calling. But it's a real fascinating debate that's going on. And it's a huge debate in the environmental arena that affects every single statute. But TSCA in particular. Several places in TSCA require to use best available data. And then the issue is, what does that mean? Industry frequently used the term sound science, and after a while the public interest groups were derisively talking about sound science as being science funded by industry, you know. I forget the term that the public interest groups had, but you know, there would be derisive comments about all these studies you read about in the U.S. News and World Report and stuff like that, we'll talk about, or USA Today, rather, we'll talk about. Well, there's a study that found an association between A and B. All right, what's that supposed to be? An association. We were in the same room. I was in the same room with McCarthy. Oh, my God. Separate from the wonderful world of TSCA is that what I loosely call the non-TSCA pressure on chemicals is going to continue. The California Green Chemistry Program continues. Washington State has a program on chemicals, controlling chemicals that are children's products. You've got the big time litigation, so the perfluorinated chemical litigation, which goes way beyond the world of firefighting and into everything else. I mean, this is, not PFOA, there's PFOA and PFAS, and I forget which, but one of them is 3M used in their stain resistance stuff. So this carpet here, almost guaranteed, has that in it. It's most, in fact, most commercial carpets have it. Right, so it's here. We track it around our feet, right? You come in here with your shoes are wet, you know, and then at some point somebody comes in here with a wet, you know, with a carpet cleaning machine that uses water, you know, and then that water gets flushed out, you know. So there's a lot of litigation that's going to be going on. One that's a little bit surprising to some people is that some of the toughest EPAs out there are private companies. Walmart is probably doing more to drive the chemical content of products right now than EPA is. Because all EPA can do is regulate. Walmart gives you shelf space. So when Walmart says, we will not buy any product that has the following chemicals in it, there's no appeal, there's no litigation, there's no one you can complain to. All you can either do is say yes, or you can agree that your product will not be on the shelves of the world's biggest retailer. Well, that's a hard decision. And it's amazing. If you get on their website, this is a bit of an old shot, but you know, beginning in 2015, you know, they wanted online ingredient disclosure, priority chemicals on packaging, safe formulations. And they have a whole scoring system now on products. And they get into the chemistry of it. This isn't just sort of very vague, general, is this nice? They don't accept some general statement like, well, we said it's organic and natural. And it's really it's really quite amazing what impact this has had. And now outfits like competitors like Target and others are along for the ride following this. Like I said, it's not completely clear from an economic, from a business perspective, what drove Walmart to do this. But at least amongst companies that I work with, sometimes Walmart literally does have a bigger impact than what EPA does, because it's more immediate. So, looking ahead. You know, unlike things like Waters of the United States, the climate change rules and stuff like that, we're not seeing a whole lot of evidence of rollback, or what I would consider structural rollback in the world of TSCA. I mean, you get some stuff that has gotten more pro-industry than if a different person were the president. So you get something like under TSCA for new chemicals, foreseeable uses being narrowly defined by the company rather than, you know, a more broad view of the design of the EPA. So you're going to get those kinds of differences, but you're not going to get differences of the extent of, for example, the difference between the Obama-era Clean Power Plan and, what does ACE stand for again?
The Affordable Clean Energy Act.
Affordable Clean Energy Act, yeah. So there you actually really do get huge differences. And also, TSCA has just got a whole bunch of deadlines. And those deadline statutes are great from a public perspective, because if EPA misses deadlines, you can sue them. And so it kind of doesn't matter whether you like the statute or not. If you're in government and you've got all these deadlines, you know if you ignore them, you're going to be in court, you're going to have to do it anyway. So why not do it the easy way rather than the hard way? Like I said, this administration is less aggressive on certain TSCA interpretation issues than the Obama EPA or than what a Clinton EPA was. But I don't know. I would say that's a 15 or a 20% issue rather than the big changes that you see on something like climate change. And the devil's just going to be in the details. There are going to be a ton of rulemakings. There's going to be a lot of litigation. People are going to be picking their fights. And wholly apart from TSCA, you're going to still see all these private sector and consumer-driven initiatives, like all the folks that are selling the like the plastic bottles that don't. What was the chemical flavor of the month a couple of years back? It was the chemical that ended up in plastic.
We talk about the biodegradable plastics.
Huh?
The biodegradable plastics.
Oh, BPA.
Bisphenol.
Right. Yeah, bisphenol A. And actually, I see it less, but everybody was like labeling their water bottles as being bisphenol A free, and all that other stuff like that. Because that was an interesting reaction, because it was never banned, and there was no regulatory agency that ever said it was a problem, and the FDA study said it didn't pose a problem. EPA said it didn't pose a problem. The European equivalent regulatory agency said it didn't pose a problem. It didn't matter, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the American Chemistry Council had this hopeless hope that maybe if they had a tougher TSCA, things like that wouldn't happen anymore, because they got frustrated and said, man, we thought we won. We had all of the agencies lined up, and still everybody wants the bisphenol A-free bottles. So you're going to still see a lot of that. And you're going to see private sector stuff continuing on, the Walmarts of the world, that are just going to say, we don't really care what the government says. This is what we're going to allow on our shelves. And then also, you have the regulatory regimes outside the United States. Because if you're a multinational player, and you can be even a small multinational player, because nowadays with the web, you know, you can have a business of five people working out of half of your house, and you can be a multinational, because you're selling on Amazon.com. So you could be selling anywhere in the world. Well, when you sell into Europe, you have to comply with REACH, and I don't care if you're a disruptor startup. You're still going to have to comply with this stuff. And so sometimes it's easy. You know, some people say that if you're in the multinational world, it's the lowest common denominator. In my experience, particularly with product issues, it's actually the opposite. Is that you end up saying, what's the meanest place that I have to deal with? And if I can satisfy them, then I'm good everywhere else. That's the way people do it in Europe, by the way, sometimes, is that in the European Union, even though they theoretically have uniform laws, as a practical matter, the Dutch and the Germans are a lot tougher than, say, the folks down in Italy or Spain. So if they have a limited legal budget, what you do is you figure out, is this going to satisfy the Germans and the Dutch? And then you say, well, what the heck? If you satisfy the Germans and the Dutch, you have a 99.9% chance you're going to be okay everywhere else. And then you take the risk and let it ride. And that's it. I'm happy to answer questions about this. I'm also happy to answer questions about, most anything else about environmental stuff.
Very well. And just so you'll know, there are some students who have class at 7:30, so we really have probably about maybe 3 to 5 minutes. But any questions from you guys? Because otherwise, I'll hog the time. That's just my personality.
Okay. Is this corrosive proof fitting case that long?
It's not so much bad laws or irrelevant law. In other words, it wasn't reversed or overturned. Some people would, but it's really just not relevant because all of the provisions that it was interpreting, they've all been changed. If you really read the corrosion proof decision, I think it was a pretty well-written case. Is I think what happened was that EPA was so confident that what they were doing was right that if they had they just skipped a bunch of steps. Because I think they were sort of under this view that, guys, it's asbestos, it's at no problem. And unfortunately, when they took that, because it wouldn't have been that much harder for them to check all the boxes of the statute. They just didn't. And so I thought it was sort of unfortunate that it kind of came out the way it came out, because it just didn't really, it was just as much EPA screwing up by just not reading the statute, I think.
Well, if I could offer a postscript, take a look. The one fact I'd point to is see which court decided that case. It's not the D.C. Circuit, which may explain a few things. If I may ask, if you have other questions, both about TSCA or just about being environmental lawyers, if I could ask you to talk to Chris one-on-one afterwards so somebody can get out, if I will leave you with two thoughts for Monday. Imagine your professor is going to walk in and hold up a test tube filled with a glowing yellow liquid and ask you, what should I do under TSCA? Think about what questions you would ask. That's probably the best way to just do the review of this stuff. Second, think about the following example. One of the companies that took the biggest TSCA penalties was a pipeline company that was bringing in natural gas from Canada into the United States. How would TSCA possibly apply in that circumstance? And that might give you a flavor as well as to how TSCA operates. So with that, other than that,
the anything? The subtext to that is I think both Tracy and I both worked on that.
All right. So with that, I hope all of you have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday. And hopefully Chris has a few minutes for further questions if you want to talk. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a safe trip.
Well, they just delayed my flight. I'm not getting to Guadalajara till 1 a.m. now. I'm thinking about rebooking to the morning. That's not safe, frankly.
It's not worth it. It's not safe. Don't do it.
Yeah, and if I get there early enough, just miss a little bit in the morning, I'll do that instead.
Catch up. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. I think my wife would be happier, too.
There are several thousand people leaving the country on foot right now.
Oh, thank you.
Sir, I wouldn't be showing up at 1 o'clock in the morning saying, I'll just go catch the local cab.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Oh, thank you. Ron Spademas, he's my research assistant this semester.
Yeah. I'm sort of helping.
The professor has mentioned that you are a person that sort of has a point of view.
I guess currently on case right now?
Yeah.
Okay. I had done, actually, I'm similar to that.